rough night. My wife snores. Snoring a lot.
I see. That's
I haven't had much sleep, which is great.
That's the best way to start a podcast I've ever heard.
I can't blame
her. Tired. My wife snores.
I know. Well, I snore, so she's like, "Well, you've snored for years." It's like, "Oh, okay." But yeah, so I think I fell asleep, you know, downstairs, woke up early in the morning, sort of 2-ish, 1-ish. And then, of course, trying to go to bed then is difficult. And then someone's snoring. And once I'm asleep, I'm fine, you know. I'm dead to the world. But so I just felt a bit rough this morning. But I've got a couple of Starbucks double espresso shot tins of
I'll
coffee.
I'll sort you right out.
I should be fine.
Shall we start with the follow-up we had from last week? Because we said we were going to talk about prototyping very briefly.
Oh, yes.
Just in case anyone was eagerly listening and waiting the whole 2 weeks for this episode on freelance prototyping.
Yep. You go ahead.
Well, I don't really do any.
Okay. Fairly easy. Okay, fair enough.
What I tend to do is designers are a nightmare. Like, I know a lot of good designers, and I work with a lot of good designers before. And the best designers are the ones that give you, like, a nice PSD or a sketch file. They've got, you know, it's all done at a sensible size, like maybe an iPhone 7 size, so you can scale up and down for the larger ones and then worry about the 4S later. And then maybe, you know, all the UI is sensible and it's obviously they've used iPhone, they know what they're doing. Whereas usually what happens is I get clients who've got, I mean, back in the old days when I used to work building websites, the problem with designers was they're all from print backgrounds, and so they'd build like brochures that were websites. Whereas nowadays the problem is that they're all web designers, and so you get things like hamburger bars and like select boxes, and it's like, what the fuck is this? You don't have a select box on iOS? What's wrong with you? You have a little roller thing. It's been there since iOS 1. Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
It drives me. Select boxes, if I see that in a design, I throw the design away. I have to say to the client, no, I'm not doing it. But in any case, what I tend to do, what I prefer to do, just because 90% of the time the designers I work with are shit, is that I will build a basic version of the app that they want in Xcode and storyboards and standard iOS components. Give them, you know, something that functionally works. So if there are forms, you can actually fill them in and submit them and stuff. And they might not look great, but they work. And that way the client can test the functionality. They can go, oh yeah, okay, that's good. Maybe we can move that around. Maybe I need to change this login flow or something. And then when it's done, either I pretty it up a bit if they just want to keep it fairly minimal, which has been a lot easier since iOS 7 came out, because the design I find is a lot easier, because you can, you know, it's white space generally and a little bit of color. You don't have to worry about making it super realistic. So quite often I just do it myself. And other times it'll then go to a designer who will basically skin what is there. So they just give me an image file with all the buttons where I've already put them, and maybe I've already chosen icons for them and they can tweak them slightly. But generally they'll just see that and then give me, you know, a prettier version of the thing I've given them, and then I can integrate it. And that works really well, because you cut out a lot of back and forth with designers, which tends to be the biggest problem I have. I had a client who used to create GitHub issues for every sentence that had like the wrong line height and stuff. And line heights in iOS are a pain in the ass. And I mean, just multiple fonts are a pain in the ass. And that was just constant, just little back and forth. Like, oh, well, the design is exactly this line height and this letter spacing. It's like, oh, no, I'm not doing this. So yeah, it generally works a lot better if I do it that way. The worst ones I have, and I won't name the project, but it's our mutual project we've both worked on.
Oh, yeah.
That guy is the fucking worst, because he'll give you designs for an iPhone 4S screen. And it's like, well, what the shit am I supposed to do with this? And then I took it 1 year. I was like, okay, how am I going to scale this for an iPhone 7 Plus? It looks ridiculous. And so I did it the best that I thought. And he looked at it, he's like, well, that doesn't look like the designs. I was like, the designs for an iPhone, like the assets are blurry, because the images, they're not vectors. They're just standard Photoshop layers. There's not much I could do with it. And he's like, oh, no, I want it all changed. It needs to be like this and this and this and this. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
So next time I made a really good hat. It's complete random tangent, but I made one of the best hacks ever in that project because they wanted an iPad version, but they wanted it to look exactly the same as it already did with the iPhone scaled up version.
Right.
But they needed it to be universal because otherwise it didn't show up in the App Store when you searched for it on the iPad, unless you searched for specifically iPhone apps in the iPad App Store.
Right.
And so they needed it to be universal, but they wanted it to look exactly the same. And I was like, it's going to be tricky because I'm using auto layout and stuff and things are going to get hairy very quickly in a lot of places. And then I made just the best hack. I put like a view controller, which is so horrible. It literally did a one of those scale animations and it just scaled everything twice the size. So I put like a view controller at the iPhone 5 size in the middle of the screen and then just did a zoom two times.
Oh my God.
Fixed a few areas where the keyboard was different because obviously it's a different type of keyboard, but it worked perfectly. They never knew. And it was beautiful. It was scaled so nicely. But yeah, so that's how I do design anyway. I tend to prefer to do it myself and then give it to a designer to make it pretty. But I don't use prototyping tools because I can't be bothered. They take too long. It's like learning a whole other language just to get it to work. And then the client wants to tweak the prototype and then you need to build the thing and then they're going to tweak it again anyway. So you might as well just do it in code in the first place.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, true. I mean, I have, well, there's different approaches. One is if I get wireframes, so you know it's easy then to follow those as best I can, but I still have that same issue that you get where they give you checkboxes or give you drop down list, you know, select just like web stuff. And so I'll go back and sort of question that and say no, can't do that, or can do that, but I've got to make a custom control, so it's not going to look like a normal iOS app, you know.
Cost twice as much. Issues.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's going to add more cost, you know. So I'll always try and push them down the route of. Because, I mean, you know, obviously we do things differently. You do stuff directly in Xcode and write, what is it, Swift mainly now.
Yeah.
I'm doing stuff with Titanium, so it's cross-platform. So I'm coding in JavaScript and it's rendering a native UI. But where possible, I want to do native controls. You know, everything I'm writing is a native UI. When I create a view, it's creating a UI view and everything. But I don't want to have to recreate a tab group with UI views. You know, I want to use a tab group because it's there, it's free, it's part of the operating system. And you know, same, and obviously that gives me the challenge with Android, and Android's the biggest issue, just because, you know, it works differently. So the key thing I try and cover with the client is the expectation of what it will look like on Android. So obviously our mutual project that we worked on had a very unique design, so it didn't really follow any standards between the two platforms. So when I did
that's
Android,
that's hamburger button on the right hand side at the top.
Yeah, so exactly.
That took you home. Like, why?
Exactly. So what I'll tend to do is like, so if I'm right now I'm working with a client who wants a prototype done to pitch to an insurance company. It's to do with pets, basically. I can't say too much, but essentially they want something they can just show. So I've been hired to sort of do a few screens when I'm using an app called Proto, or a web app called Proto.io, which actually is pretty good. I find it much easier and quicker to do and to work with than some of the other prototyping tools, which, like you say, end up. Taking ages, you can't reuse any of it anyway. It is literally just an indicative thing of what this thing could look like. But it actually is really fast. You can do sort of drag and drop transitions. So you can sort of just say, you know, this button, drag that to that screen, bang, you've got a slide in transition done. So you can do something. I try not to do everything. All I'm really doing is trying to establish the navigation pattern of the app so that they can see, you know, this is what you know, you're gonna need a nav window, or you're gonna need a tab group. This is the approach I'm gonna take to get your app to work. Once I've established that, there and some basic button layouts and, you know, field layouts and things like that, but I do everything black and white. You know, I make sure all the colors, because it defaults to like blue colors, and I change everything to black and white, make it very clear that it's a wireframe, that there's no. They even said, "Oh, is it going to have our colors and stuff?" Nope, that's not what I'm doing at this stage. All I'm trying to do is establishing how to get your app to fit within the navigation pattern of iOS or Android or whatever. And then what I'll sometimes do is then mock up a sort of just one screen or two screen version in Android or in an Android way, just to show, well, this is what your tab group's going to look like. It's going to be an action bar at the top and the icons will be at the top of the screen instead of the bottom, just so there's no confusion when they get the app and go, oh, the tabs are at the bottom. The tabs are at the top for Android, and they disappear when you click a window. And it's like, and I can't get back. It's like, well, you can, because there's a back button on Android. That's the whole point. That's the way that tab navigation pattern works. So I try and do that really just to clear up any mess. And then that gives me that gives me sort of something that I can then start coding with. But you're right. I mean, what ends up happening is I'm doing an app for service industry where you can sort of I can't really say too much about that either. But basically, there's specialists that you can talk to, ask questions from, and stuff like that. And you can have chats with and you can have phone calls with. So I did the original design, and I'm not a designer. I always tell people I'm not a designer. I'm going to follow, you know, standard UE patterns and make things, you know, align and look nice, but I'm not a trained designer. And then what happened was,
what I always say.
Yeah. And what tends to happen then is if the client's getting too picky in terms of, oh, can we try these colors? Can we try those colors? It's like, well, look, I don't want to go back and forth just experimenting here. Why don't you get somebody to come back to me with your colors that you want to use, with maybe button styles, you know, get a designer involved at that point and say, you know, get them to have a look at it. And usually these people have got a designer, especially this client. And it's like, well, that, you know, pay that guy to do it. You know, he should be doing it. That's his job. So basically what happened there was then I sent them a copy of the app. They came back with what was supposed to be, I think I might've said this before, but it was, you know, color changes. So brand colors, maybe a font, maybe sort of button styling as in, you know,
the worst is when they give you like their brand guidelines. It's like a 48 page PDF, and they exactly, go, there you go, exactly. Do it like that. And it's like,
yeah, exactly.
No.
I don't do that. I'm like, I'm not going to translate that. I want you to give me the designs, basically. So give me the button colors, give me the styles, give me the border radiuses, give me what you want. He came back with a hell of a lot of changes in terms of, you know, instead of just changing a button's changing a button shape or color on the screen, he decided to sort of change the UI. It turned out only to be about a day's work, but then obviously I've got to go back to the client and say, look, this is another day's work to integrate this because, you know, there's changes here that are not just swapping colors over. But, you know, we ended up with a better looking app, which is nice. I don't mind that. But, I get the same problems as you. You get a designer who knocks something up. Typically, it's an iOS design they do, which is fine for you, but it's not for me because I get this iOS design, which typically, again, is done on maybe a 4-inch screen rendering, like an iPhone 5 is typically what I'll get these days. It's even worse if they give you like a plus size only design because it's like, well, there's just too much stuff there. It's not going to shrink down easily.
Yeah, especially when it's not scrollable views.
Yes, exactly.
When it's like, okay, well, you need to like, I can scale it, you know, because luckily the iPhone 5, iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus are all the exact same ratio. So you can just go bloop, bloop.
Exactly.
Like, but the other making an accordion symbol with my hands for people who can see that. Bloop, bloop. But the 4S, you can't. You miss like top and bottom.
Exactly, exactly. And the other thing that's really important when you're doing this stuff as well that I've found and I've learned is that one mustn't get too bogged down with trying to do some of these clever designs, because at the end of the day, the client tends to not know what they're doing, you know, and they'll admit that, you know, they haven't built apps before or whatever, or you know, they don't know about this stuff, which is why they've hired you. And so I had a situation with a fitness app. It was a food recipe app. And I was very proud of myself because I created this custom ruler. You know, the designer had put a ruler basically in the app, and the way it worked is it was like a dial, you know, like a sort of electricity dial, the old fashioned electricity dials in the sort of horizontal things.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And that was how you did your measurements. So you'd sort of say my height is this and you'd scroll the dial like a ruler, and my weight is this and you'd scroll the dial like a ruler. Now, in hindsight, what I should have done at the time is said, that's a crazy design and we should just do a, you know, looking at other fitness apps out there and how they work and how you input weights, we should just have, you know, a nice big font there with a up and down, or you can just key it in or tap it or scroll.
Here's a UI date picker.
Or a picker, there's all these, let's just use one of these. That's what I should have done. I didn't, and I thought, I'll have a crack at this. So I spent, you know, days writing this custom control to make this work. I mean, I got paid for it and everything, but it was just frustrating. So I write this custom control and I go and put it in, and the performance isn't as good as I want it to be. And certainly the client thinks, oh, it's a bit slow to select. And I'm like, well, the trouble is now I've done this custom control, which is sort of rendering fine as one. But if I render it as two on the screen, obviously there's double the amount of rendering that's going on. And it's also rendering all of the little ticks, you know, all those little ticks on the ruler. It's rendering the numbers and the labels on there because they wanted numbers on there. So it's generating
image.
Yeah,
that's what you want, big image.
Complex thing. So I was messing around with this, and then I finally said, look, can we just use a different control? And he's like, oh, I'm fine with that. And I was like, oh, my God. And if I'd just done that in the beginning, it would have saved, you know, a lot of pain. So I don't think it's necessarily us being arsy when we're sort of saying, oh, you can't have that, you can't have this. I think it's almost like, well, I almost treat it like the approach of, remember dealing with IE6 when you did web stuff? Oh, it was God. Like, you were always taught to basically knock up the basic web page, and then selectively enhance it from there. So knock up a basic web page in HTML and CSS that's going to render on IE6, that's going to work. Now we can then forget IE6 almost and just start putting in, you know, nice bits for other browsers, so we get nice effects that works, but it will still degrade nicely and work nicely in IE6. And I almost go with that approach. It's almost like I'm going to use standard UE controls. I'm going to put everything together in a way that works initially, that gives them pickers or whatever, using standard little components that I've got. Then if we want to selectively enhance that later, great, we'll change that, we'll add that, we'll move that, we'll whatever. But we've got a basic thing working that's doing the functional work that you need it to do. It still looks nice, still follows the UE patterns and everything. You know, it's not a crap design or anything, but it's getting the job done. Then later we can come back and say, well, maybe we can make that control look nicer or whatever. And then that's a lot easier because you're not being bogged down with that detail at the very start.
Yeah.
And you can still give them something functional they can test.
People who've listened to this show and us talking about freelancing before will know that I have no problem with being arsy and pushing back with a client. In fact, I border on being rude to clients because I find it separates the bad clients from the good ones fairly easily because the good ones will take it. But I had one client who they had this is so frustrating. So they had this app and it was decent and it was nice, but they weren't getting the traction they needed. They were going to run out of money fairly soon. And during the process, their designer had wanted to do a load of fancy shit. And I'd said, no, we need to, you don't have the budget or the time to do this. You need to make it streamlined, make it standard. And it was great. And then it got to version 2 of the app. And I came into a meeting expecting them to be like, oh, okay, here's the new functionality we want to add. Here's the new cool stuff we want to add. Here's like the iOS 8 extensions we want to add, because that was like big at the time and they wanted to get featured by Apple, and that was like the surefire way to do it, was to use the new stuff. Instead, they had a complete redesign of the app. No new functionality, just a redesign. And the redesign was a mixture of the Google whatever material design thing and a Windows 8 phone UI. So rather than having tab bar at the bottom with 5 separate sections, you had, ironically in hindsight, slightly iOS 11 style massive title at the top of the screen. And that was the heading. And then you swiped the whole page to go to like the next tab. And like you could see the words along the top, but they got cut off. So you could never see all of the options. You had to swipe through them. And that would change the page beneath. And I looked at it, I said, no, this ain't happening. And they're like, well, it is. We want to do it. You pushed back a lot on the designer. We've got to give them their chance now. And it's like, no, you don't. You're the boss. You need to be able to tell the designers when they're doing a shit job, and they're doing a shit job. And they pushed back on it. And I said, well, I'm not building it. And they're like, well, you have to. And I was like, no, I don't. I'm a freelancer. Like, you've not contracted me to build version 2. I've not agreed to it. I've not given you a quote. I'm not doing it. I've no interest in it at all. And then they got a different designer. And then they built it that way. And then they went bust. So that's a
Well, this is
the moral of the story is listen to me.
Exactly. But this is the other thing I was going to say with that fitness thing that I forgot. Another important thing is, you know, you save yourself some time going down this route of saying, well, let's just do this way, because it's the proper way to do it, and it's going to be the quickest way to do it, and we're going to get the best performance. The other thing is this particular client I deal a lot with. I don't know if you deal with startups a lot. So I deal with startups who have got funding. They've either got self-funding or they've got investors or whatever. And big lesson I've learned with invested startups is or startups that have started with their own money but then bring in an external investor, is first of all, you get this pain in the ass person who comes in and suddenly wants to know everything about how everything works and the security and all that stuff. And it's like, oh my God, can I just get on with the job? The second thing is, the situation can change when external investors come in. So this particular app, the one that I was messing around with, this ruler, and then we finally went down with this, you know, normal, but a simpler interface that worked much, much better, is that they were part of a, I can't remember the terminology, but it's basically part of a program through another company. Not VC, but almost like, you know, like these, I can't really say much about the company.
Incubator type thing.
Yeah, incubator type thing, where a bigger company is bringing in other startups who are in that same space almost. You'd almost argue it's a competitive thing, but they're just helping these people along to maybe buy them or whatever. And maybe it's to do with their APIs or something like that, you know, they want them to use. So they had this incubation type thing going on with this external money coming in. And of course, these people have then got contacts. They've got their own development teams they work with. They've got their own consultants they work with, etc. So what eventually happened was, which was always the plan, I was always going to develop this sort of MVP type product, minimal viable product, that they could get out there into the App Store. And I did that. And that was always the aim. And I wasn't going to stick around. They were going to eventually employ someone. I was going to hand over. And that's typically a normal thing that can happen. For me, anyway, in terms of those sort of startups.
Yeah.
But of course, that's the only way I work.
I generally.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'll get you to version 1.0 and then I'm out of there. I don't want to be touching
exactly,
it after that.
Exactly. And of course, what happened was they ended up bringing in someone else who then came in, just like you would and like I've done when you get, you know, I'm not sure you take on many apps that are existing apps, but you know, you
very,
get an existing.
Very rarely.
Exactly. 9 times out of 10, what I'll do is say to people, I can't work with this, not because I'm fussy, but because I think it's going to take me longer to work with this than it is if I just rebuild it. So that'll be the normal route that I'll go down. And that's exactly what happened.
I typically do that a lot.
Yeah. So this other person came in. They maintained what was in the App Store. But in the meantime, they were rewriting the back end, which the back end was fine. It was written with Node and MongoDB, and it was hosted on a cloud service, and there was nothing wrong with the back end. But they weren't familiar with that back end. They wanted to do their own. You know, it's the typical thing. If you've got like if you hire a .NET developer to come in and help you, they're going to want to rewrite the back end in .NET because that's what they do. Hmm. So what happened was the back end got rewritten. They maintained the current version. Then he started rewriting a load of the front end with a completely different the app with a completely different language, still cross platform but completely different. And then he left. So he then left the client with this other sort of version 1.1 in this state of incompletion. So then they outsourced abroad, and that team then used a completely different solution. So now there's a new version of the app in the App Store that shares, you know, the name only of what I did. It's completely rewritten code. It's a completely rewritten back end. It's taken them several updates to get it looking right because they started using hybrid technology, you know, the web wrap stuff, and it just looked awful. So they literally took away that native interface and went for a hybrid solution. It's ridiculous. But all I'm saying is you can go down all this effort during the development process, and then right at the very end, it can all just get rewritten anyway. So my approach now is just try and keep things as simple as possible, get stuff done.
Not as quickly as possible.
As quick as possible. I don't want to bang crap out, but I want to get it done so it works well. The client gets what they want. I get paid. Everyone's happy. And they have a great looking, you know, good performing app in the App Store. And I find the best way of doing that is to keep it really simple. And also from my point of view, I've literally, I had it the other day. Writing as little code as possible for me is always good. So I'll try and make, you know, modules and components that are tested and reusable and cross-platform. And I can then say, right, I want to implement my form control, and I want to implement my input fields. And those input fields have got error handling. They're cross-platform. I don't need to test them on Android. I know they work. And so to implement them is just a few lines of code. And I love that.
I'm doing that at the moment. I've got a project which is all about kind of like feed, so it's like a social feed, like something like Facebook or Instagram or whatever. And they've got the typical social media thing of having, you know, there's text, and in the text you can have like hashtags or at username.
Right. Yeah.
And obviously you need to select that as a, like in the web, it's easy to have that be, you know, an anchor tag, and you click on it and it takes you to another page. On iOS, not so easy. That's actually quite a difficult thing to do if you have labels and things, because you need to build up attributed strings, you need to search for the right words to highlight, you need to make them tappable, then it needs to read them and work out if it can go somewhere, blah, 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 blah. And so I've already done that previously, and so this time it's super easy because I've already got all those modules written, and I've done them nicely and separately, almost like little pods, so I can just go bloop, pop them in, done, easy.
Exactly.
So it's kind of nice when you see something that you can reuse, that you think to yourself in future, okay, I spent 3-4 days writing that piece of code. I should spend another day on it just to make it absolutely solid, and then I should upload it somewhere so I've got it for later usage. I mean, treat it like an open source project, even if you don't open source it or stick it on GitHub or whatever. At least you've then got it somewhere that you can pull it in for future projects, because 9 times out of 10, you will reuse stuff like that.
That's the thing. I mean, and it can be very easy as a developer to get so bogged down with the apps that you're building that you just forget to do this sort of stuff, and you're reinventing the wheel.
So much time in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, I've got I've written a lovely little library that it's a UE control library now that I can I can have fully working cross-platform controls that do pop-ups, that do selectors, that, you know, comply and look like an iOS selector. It is an iOS selector, but on Android, you know, behaves differently, but does the same thing, has the same event handling and everything else, works on an iPad with a popover, you know, all those things. It's just exactly the same control, but it just works on all, across all those devices. And I'm doing an app, a medical app, which is quite complicated because it's got a lot of form fields. There's a lot of sections to fill in, and there's a lot of form fields. And so what I've done is written a form handler, almost like a form control, like a so basically a UE view effectively. But what it does is it handles the sort of form elements within it. So you lay out the screens, and then I've got a separate bit of code that I can, it's just a JSON configuration basically because it's all JavaScript, where I can say what the required fields are. The error handling is all automatic. If
things like up and down buttons, so you can go to like the next field, previous field,
exactly.
If you leave the page, the keyboard to dismiss, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And the nice thing is I don't have to set individual field values or get individual field values. I just say to the form, I want you to get all the values, get values. It returns me a JSON object with all of the IDs of the elements with their values. Nice. And the set works the other way around. So this is now updating one global object that I can then save. If you then open that screen again, all it's doing is iterating that object, populating the form, is then populating all of those elements based on the IDs. So basically, I add a new field and there's no logic to write for that field. You know, if it's a required field, it will automatically show an error. If it's not, it will automatically save it. So, you know, whenever you type something in it and hit the save button or whatever, it will just save it. And if you reload that screen, it will repopulate. And that's just saved me so much time because I had this. You know, you have that load in the beginning where you're writing all these controls, but once they're all tested and working, I can go to the other screens that need doing and just say, I just need one of those controls. And I've even written things like collapsible controls. So there's like a toggle switch, which might say, home address is same as incident address or something.
Yeah, I know the sort of thing you mean.
Yeah, and then if you toggle it, it will auto expand this section, which is then a subview which contains these other elements. So that's called, I've called that, because I'm writing stuff in XML when you lay out screens. That's called a collapsible view. And a collapsible view automatically has a switch and automatically has a caption and automatically has a subview with other stuff in it. And so all of that stuff just works really well. So, and we never really prototyped the app. I think we did a couple little prototypes, but really we're using a Google Doc to lay out the screens in terms of what fields are required. And because I've educated the client and myself on what types of fields we're using or controls we're using, i.e. collapsible, tabbed bar, etc., as he's adding more screens that he needs, he knows the control type. So he's saying, this tabbed bar, this drop down, or pop-up,
nice.
You know, stuff like that. So it just makes it really, really easy. And because of the way that the code and the system I use, you can define your own XML tag. So I can create like custom controls that have a more meaningful description. So like my picker, there's a standard picker which will give you the normal UE picker. Mine's called Picker Field because it appears like a field. It has a box, it has a caption, it even has an error message. But when you tap it, a picker appears or a popover appears. So it's just really, that sort of stuff is, I can't recommend doing that enough.
One thing that's worth mentioning with that kind of stuff is that it would be very easy for you to spend an hour or so looking on CocoaPods or whatever the equivalent is for cross-platform stuff and finding something like that, because there will be something like that that exists already that someone's built, like a form builder, it'll probably be called, that will do a lot of that stuff, maybe not quite how you want it, but a lot of it. It's very tempting to do that, download that third-party dependency that you have no idea of how it works, stick it in your project, go, that works, and then maybe edit the files that are there to tweak it to your particular setup, but then you can no longer update it from the repository because you've changed it and you don't know what's changed if they fix bug stuff. It's always worth, unless it's something like really core, like for example, in nearly every project I use the Realm mobile database, which is a ridiculously fast database. It's much better than Core Data, which is a piece of shit. So I always use that, because, and I have no idea of how that works. That stuff is like voodoo magic to me. But it's a very well-defined piece used by probably tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 developers. It's not going anywhere. It's well-documented, and I use it all the time, so it's fine. Whereas literally in the project I'm just working on, I used a CocoaPod, and I needed to do like some image zoom thing. And I downloaded a CocoaPod, and I integrated it, and it worked. And I showed it to the client, and they're like, yep, that's great, thanks. But then rather than just leaving it there and then moving on to the next thing, I then spent half an hour taking that code and just rewriting it in Swift in the way that I'd do it with my naming conventions, looking at it, understanding how it worked, and then just having that in my project, not as a external dependency, but as its own piece of code, because now I know what it does and how it works. It doesn't need to be this third-party thing that's floating around that's, you know, mystery meat. So it's always worth... I mean, I never used to do that because you want to get stuff done as quickly as possible, so you just load up all these dependencies into your project, but then you get shafted very quickly later on when something updates and suddenly your dependency doesn't work and you've got no idea how it works and the client's screaming at you because an iOS update's just come out that's broken everything and you're like, oh, and you're trying to fix it and you can't and you've got other clients and it gets messy. Especially around iOS update time, because if you've got something that's going to break and you've used it in a few projects, all those clients are going to want that fixed at the same time, at a time when you're usually busiest, because it's a time when everyone wants the new fancy stuff being done or apps being updated. So it, I've had a few years where I've got to that point and I've been like, oh my God, why did I do this? Use third-party dependencies, but just pick them wisely, and if you can, sort of, you know, morph them into your own style and project.
Yeah, it's like the selective enhancement type thing again. I mean, what I try and do is the same with what you're talking about. I can use CocoaPods within projects as well, but there's also like third-party native modules that you can use, and many developers in my sort of space, using the tools I use, will just go, you know, they'll have like 10 of these modules, they'll immediately shove in. Slide menus, maybe slide menus or attributed string controls or whatever. You know, there'll just be a load of modules they dump in that's like their normal modules. That's how they start a project. And that's great. But you've just loaded your project with all these modules that in many cases you can not do the same thing, but you can get, you know, rather than load in a few megabyte module to do one specific feature for an image view, you could actually just change the app design slightly and you don't need that module at all and you've got a better solution. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like that's being added to work around a problem.
I work on a project where they import the entirety of the AF networking, which is like a big networking thing on iOS. They import the whole of that, which is huge because it's designed to do like all your networking, and they use it just to sanitize some URLs, like
exactly,
just to like remove some plus signs or whatever. And it's like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah,
this is huge. Funny enough, the project I'm working on at the moment is one that I got because they wanted me to do a review of their app, and I did an 8,000 word report of their app over 2 days, which was just, I just slated it. It was so bad, and the app was like 150 megs in size and should have been about 20, it's because it had 56 different third-party frameworks in it, but they weren't even done through a dependency manager. They were just loaded in, and when I asked why, they were like, oh yeah, we tweak quite a lot of them. And it's like, so you've no idea what version you're running, what fixes there are for any of these things. Nope. It's like, okay, that's interesting. And so now I've removed all of that cruft, and I've just rewritten it in Swift. It's much smaller, and it's tiny now, and it's much faster. And they didn't need nearly any of those dependencies.
Well, it's exactly that. So there's a few things from my side because of the way that the stuff I use works. Having those dependencies does make your apps bigger, and definitely with Titanium it can make them, you know, much bigger if you're bringing in something that just does one specific little feature. The other thing is there's been changes in the past with the way Titanium worked, where I think it was when, you know, the 32-bit, 64-bit with iOS, and on Android, there's the V8 stuff to do with Java. And basically what happens is those native modules have to be rebuilt. They just have to be recompiled with the latest, you know, SDK, which is fine. But in some cases, things break. You know, that module will work fine technically, apart from the fact that it wouldn't because of the 64-bit thing, but you know what I mean, functionally it will still do the same thing if it could, but the moment you rebuild it with the later SDK, something breaks, something changes, and now you're fixing stuff. And in my space, I mean, I do some little bits of native stuff, but very small. Typically what will happen is the developer is dependent on these modules. You know, they write JavaScript, they can write JavaScript do crazy stuff with JavaScript, but they need these native modules to do specific things. If that native module suddenly doesn't work because it doesn't build in the latest SDK, because the client needs you to build a 64-bit version because the 32-bit version is going to be removed from the App Store finally, then suddenly you've got this dependency on this module that's doing a key thing in your app that you've got no idea how it works. The developer wrote it 2 years ago, has thought, well,
hasn't updated it in 2 years,
has moved on, and suddenly you've got, you know, yourself in a mess. Now, these hurdles only happen now and again, thankfully.
This is exactly what I was saying. Exactly what I was saying about iOS release times, because it's at that point that these things go wrong. Because it's exactly as you say, when you recompile it in Xcode, I noticed that especially with Swift, because a lot of the time you import modules, and it might be, you know, a Swift 1.2 it was written it for, and when you try and run it in Xcode 8, it'll go, we don't do Swift 1.2. That needs to be updated to Swift 2. And so then you do the automatic Swift update, and then it doesn't work because it fucks up the file. And then you go to GitHub to the person, you're like, hey, have you got a Swift 2 version? And you see, like, last updated 2 years ago, and there's just issues page. It's just got, like, 80 issues, and it's people go, it doesn't work in Xcode. And then there's someone going, oh, I've got a fork of it that works, but I changed a load of stuff for my project. And you're like, oh,
exactly.
It's a nightmare. The final thing I just wanted to say about this kind of thing is something that really annoys me, which is one of the things I often say to, like, designers or clients, if they give me the designs like an iPhone 7 size, and then I say, well, what about the iPhone 4S? Or, you know, like, what are you going to do for that screen size? And they go, And then what I want to be able to say is to, fuck them, let's just make it iOS 10 only. And it won't. You don't have to worry about the iPhone 4S because it's not supported. So I've downloaded the app, and you think, great, perfect, wonderful. Until you submit your app to the App Store, feeling a bit cocky about it all, you upload it, and then you get a rejection. Why? Because on the iPad, it doesn't work properly. Because the iPad still uses... You still have to... your iPhone app has to run on the iPad, and the iPad size, it uses the iPhone 4 screen. So if you've done auto layout, and you've done it all magically and no scroll views because you don't need it because you're at the right ratio, suddenly the bottom half of your app's missing. And so the App Store team reject you. That happened to me a little while ago. And I was like, oh, I forgot about the iPad. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And I do not understand why that requirement is still there. I mean, when Steve Jobs introduced the iPad, he did it taking the piss out of Android by saying, look at these. These aren't even real apps. They're baby apps. And he was like showing like OpenTable on an Android tablet, and it was just the iPhone, the Android version blown up stupidly because it was like the rows were still 44 pixels high, but they were now like 1024 pixels wide rather than 220 or whatever they're supposed to be. But that's what you have now. It's like, well, why? In this day and age, iPad apps don't need to run iPhone apps on them because you can't even... Nightmare. You can't even find them half the time because the App Store, you have to specifically say iPhone only in that weird little toggle. Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah.
We've got loads to discuss.
The Falcon.
Oh, the Falcon. The Falcon. I'm for people that listened to the last show, they'll know that we discussed the UCS Millennium Falcon from LEGO, and we wondered how big it would be, and we had a little bit of back and forth about it, and we were both wrong. It was actually, I think I said it was going to be the largest Star Wars set made, but not the largest Lego one, and I was wrong.
Right.
It's the largest Lego set by a considerable margin, because it's 7,541 pieces.
Have you seen the box?
I have seen the box. The box has wheels on it.
The box has wheels because you wouldn't be able to get it out of the store. That is absolutely crazy. What I am pleased about was what I mentioned when we were talking about it. I think you said we talked about, is it going to be Force Awakens? Is it going to be original? And I think you said, you know, they'll probably do two things, which is awesome. But what I'm really pleased about is they've done the cockpit. They've done the cockpit really nicely. So it's not a cockpit made out of aerials anymore. You know, it's actually, it just looks in proportion, you know, with the Lego figures and everything. It just looks, and there's more rounded features of like the cockpit tunnel. And the gunnery, the gun on top. There's also a little drop down. Have you seen the video where they demonstrate the stuff? There's a little drop down turret. And there's interior stuff. So you can actually pull little panels off and there's interior stuff. So I think it's going
to
be
crazy. Which works
crazy.
Similarly to how the Super Star Destroyer works, which is what I said last time. But they're actually in proportion, so it works. And the Super Star Destroyer, you lift it up and you have like this massive room, which looks stupid because it's like the size of 20 Star Destroyers or something. It's not quite right. Whereas in this one, you lift up like a little panel and you can just see that little seating area where they play the game that's name I've forgotten for the second time.
Yes, have I?
Yep.
I call it Holochess, but yeah, it's got a proper name.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. So you can see that little table and stuff, and it's like, oh, yes. It's really nice. And it's nice how you can tweak it depending on whether you want Force Awakens or original Falcon. Yeah. Like, you've got a changeable radar shield, which you sort of talked about last time because you've done that with one of your ones, and you can change two little bits at the front, and that's pretty much it. And
yeah, I love that
sets of minifigures. It's nice.
I love that in the video where he was like, and we can change it easily between them, and he sort of, you know, the dish changes.
It's two in one build.
He's like, oh, you've done it. But then he says, then he goes to the mandibles and just goes, takes off this tiny brick on the top front of his mandible. And it's like, it's almost like, it's like Clark Kent Superman. You know, it's like, here's Superman, let's just take his glasses off. There, look, it's Clark Kent. Or well, other way around.
I love the way that they described it as a two-in-one build, because usually, like in Lego, if it's a two-in-one build, it means that you can use the bricks to make two completely different things, like a truck and a plane or something, whereas this is literally swap the radar, take a brick off, done.
Yeah, just put the
different minifigures in.
With all of that crap that's all over it, you know, all of those little intricate pieces, I just love the fact that if you just did the dish, someone would go, ooh, hold on a minute. Those two bricks on the front of the mandibles, they shouldn't be there.
I love that you get a little Minoc with it. That's pretty cool. And also the minifigures of Han and Leia, you can turn the heads around and they've got the little breathing apparatus that they use when they're getting the Minocs off. That was the bit that I was like, ooh.
It looks really good, and it looks like it'll take a long time. Did they say a price? Because you guessed something about 600 or something.
No, the press release, £649.
Wow.
And you can see it today in London at Leicester Square and at a few other of the big Lego stores around the world. September 14th, VIP members can pre-order it. Order it, I guess. It'll just come the next day, I should imagine. And then October 1st, everyone else can. But to be honest, October 1st, there ain't going to be any because the VIP members will buy them all.
I don't know if there's a minimum.
I imagine that there's going to be like a limit of one per person or two per person. I can't imagine.
I'm hoping it's two.
People buy 20. Well, yeah.
I'm hoping it's two. One of those is going to be a little investment, I think. Not that I'm going to hang on for it for a huge amount of time, because look what's happening to now all those people on eBay that have got boxed versions. I mean, there's still going to be a market for people who want a boxed version, I suppose, and it is the original, but I'm sure there's a lot that have been devalued.
Yeah, there's a lot that you wanted to have sold a little while back. Like, as soon as rumours of this UCS Falcon came out, you'd be like, yeah, I'll sell my old one now.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they were, like, worth, like, what, like 4,000 some of them were going for?
Oh, there were some that were somewhat, I mean, even ones that were built and then disassembled and put in bloody dodgy bags without the original box were going for, you know, a couple of grand. If you've got the original one in the box, sealed, you know, not used at all, then it's easily four or five grand. And some of them are, you know, original box in the original shipping box, just the cardboard box it came in from the Lego store, and that's not opened. The whole thing is not opened. You can't even see it. And those are like £6,000. And that's the sort of thing where you've got to make sure.
That's when you open it and you find out that there was a shipping mistake. They sent the wrong one.
Yes. That would be amazing. It's the Taj Mahal or something. Oh God, which might actually be worth as much. but yeah, crazy. God knows how long it'll take to build, but I am definitely getting one this time. I mean, I missed a boat last time. I think it was about £300 or £400 last time, and I just either didn't bother or couldn't afford it or whatever. I've definitely got to do it this time.
I have only one Star Wars Lego regret, which was the Imperial shuttle. You know, the white one where it's got the three wings that sort of come down like a triangle. And then they fold up and they've got
the
Imperial shuttle. And they had one of those and it was like £300 and I couldn't afford it at the time. And I was like, oh. And then when I got the money together to buy it, it'd been discontinued. And I was like, oh, and I was gutted. And then when the Super Star Destroyer came out, that's the time that I was like, I'm buying it on May the 4th because I get the 10% discount and I'll have it. This one, I really want it and I know that I will miss it if I don't buy it. But I'm like, oh, it's so much money. And I'm like, oh, I could buy a HTC Vive and I do want one of those a bit more than I want more Lego. It's tricky. It's a tricky one. I'll probably buy it.
Yeah.
It's going to be an expensive September. It's my birthday tomorrow, so depending on how much birthday money I get and depending on how expensive September the 12th is going to be will depend on whether I buy one on September 14th.
Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen with that. You know, is it going to be September 12th? Well, I guess we're segueing into September 12th, that conversation. We can do.
We're all Millennium Falcon, aren't we?
Yeah.
So September 12th, I mean, following on from previous years, it's going to be the same as every year because it's always an announcement on Tuesday. Tuesday, they'll make the announcement. The Friday will be when the pre-orders open for the phone.
That's what I thought.
Talk about that in a bit more detail in a second, perhaps. But Friday, the pre-orders go live for the phone and the Apple Watch and anything else that's coming. And then the following Wednesday, or maybe the Wednesday after that, depending on the lead time, iOS 11 will come out. And then on the Friday, the actual phone is released. So it's either a one-week or a two-week pre-order window. Sometimes it's 2 weeks, isn't it? Sometimes it's one. It varies.
Yeah.
I think it's been two the last couple of years.
I think it was as well. I'm trying to think. I think it was 2 weeks, yeah.
Then you also, I mean, you get the curveballs as well. Like last year we had AirPods, but the AirPods weren't available. They were like, oh, they'll be available in October. And then they weren't. And then November they came and it was like, now you can pre-order them like a week before they came out, I think. So if they do a 4K Apple TV, it's anyone's guess as to whether it'll be it's available now or you can pre-order it on Friday or it'll be available next month.
Yeah, and they did it 1 year with iPads and I think it's when they did the Retina MacBook Pro, I think. They did it so that they, and the iPad, they had this sort of staggered announcement or staggered release. So, you know, you had to wait till October before you could get like the iPad.
Quite often they release stuff in October, but they'll announce it now because they don't want to do two events, which is fair enough. So I guess the real question is Apple Watch. I mean, I can't imagine that the Apple Watch is going to be massively supply constrained or delayed massively. I would expect, and I could be wrong, this is just conjecture, but I would expect that whatever new Apple Watches they release will be available for pre-order the Friday, the 15th or 16th, whatever it is, the Friday after the announcement. And then will be available, delivered or available in store the week or 2 weeks later. And I imagine that would be the same for the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus. The curveball is the iPhone 8, whether it's pre-order on the Friday and it comes 2 weeks later, the same as the other phones, or whether it's pre-order then, but it's not coming until October. Or whether it's this is coming in October and the pre-orders will just be announced at some point, like a few days before they open, and then you can pre-order it and it'll be October time. And I really don't know. There's a lot of conflicting information about that. A few people are saying, oh, supply chain, they've got some. So it could be, you know, the normal pattern. Or it could be completely, you know, like they're going to announce it, but it's not coming until October. Might even be November.
I guess the weird thing is, it's how big a deal it is on the day. Because if they don't ship it immediately, then they're at risk of cannibalizing sales of that because there's going to be people that, you know, or will you have a situation where people go, okay, I'm not going to buy the 7S or the 7S Plus because I'm going to wait for the iPhone Pro, even though they might not get one because it's supply constraint and whatever.
Yeah.
So they don't make those sales. Yeah. So you end up with 7Ss don't sell. There's obviously some people that will still buy them, but they don't sell because people are waiting for the Pro or the 8, whatever it's going to be called. But if the 8, if this Pro or 8, whatever, we'll call it the 8, if it is a big deal and it's like the main, which, and you think it would be, you know, you don't think they're going to have an iPhone event where they're going to say, because otherwise the 7S is going to have to be amazing, you know, if that's going to be the focus. So the 7S is going to go through the normal routine updates, probably speed and maybe camera improvements and maybe the...
Maybe
while it's charging and things like that. But the 8 surely is going to be the thing that's going to be, you know, the biggest percentage of that keynote or whatever of that event. It's there. That's what they're going to be talking about. So to talk about it and make it such a huge deal and effectively say, like we've talked about before, that you're sort of getting next year's technology this year as a preview, if you like, to then say you can't buy it till October just seems like a really bad move.
But I think they've done that before, though. You get stuff like that. I mean, it's slightly different.
Didn't they do it with the first redesign of the MacBook Pro when it Remember when the 15, yeah, I think so. Inch? It was like
they certainly did revolution. It. They certainly did it 2 years ago when they announced in one event the Apple Watch, the MacBook, the new 12-inch MacBook, and then the iPad Pro, because the iPad Pro wasn't until the following month that it was available for pre-order, and the Apple Pencil alongside it and all the rest of it. But you could buy the case for it in September, but you couldn't buy the thing till October.
I do love it when they balls up all that stuff, where you get like a pencil delivered before... I think I had the pencil delivered before the... I had the pencil and the smart cover delivered before the iPad Pro came. It's just like, God, great. So I've got a case that I can look at. I've got this smart cover that I can see the size of, but I can't do anything with it until next week when the other thing comes. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, again, it's going to be the old, you know, 8 a.m., 7:50 a.m., refreshing the app to try and see when it becomes live story again.
But, yes, just the usual.
I'm hoping they don't change the watch too much. I'm hoping they don't change the watch, but at least the straps, at least the existing straps should hopefully work. God. There's no reason to change that.
I can't imagine that. I mean, people spend more money on the straps than they do on the watch. You think, how much is the watch? The watch, you can get it for 250 quid. Most people I know have got several straps. So, you know, I've got the I got a leather one that was like 120 quid. I got like another one that was about the same. I think I've got three of the sport bands that are now 50 quid each. Three of the nylon ones, which are about the same. And all of that adds up to way more than my sport Apple Watch cost, probably more than my steel one cost. So if they were to release a new watch that they didn't fit with, I think they'd be in a lot of trouble because they're doing the watch straps. Like, I can't see a reason to change it because they're not going to make it thinner than that, realistically, especially for a few generations.
Exactly.
I mean, I guess what they could do... If they did go eventually down that route, let's say a few generations' time, they make a much thinner watch or a smaller one and they need different lugs, I imagine they would sell some kind of adapter for a ridiculous price that lets you, you know, put a little thin lug in and then it goes to a fat one to put your old watch bands on. I can't imagine that they're going to not do something like that because people have got a huge collection of bands. Like, what are you going to do with them? They obviously put a huge amount of thought into this connector for the bands because it's so good compared to every other watch I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So I think they've got to keep it the same. But in, for this year, certainly, the rumour is that the watch is going to be exactly the same. Going to have LTE in it. So it might even be slightly thicker. Because, I mean, the Series 2 and the Series 1 are ever so slightly different proportions. Most people don't notice it or know about it, but they are ever so slightly different, slightly thicker, slightly thinner at the sides. We talked about this last week, so I won't go into it too much, but if they're adding LTE, I imagine that's going to be like the step-up watch, so it'll probably be the same as the iPads are, where you have the starting price, which is all the Apple Watches you have now, and then you add like 130 quid, and then you've got Apple Watch with cellular, like just like the iPad pricing works. And if they do that and add, God knows what else they'll add, but, you know, faster processor, more RAM, whatever it'll be, I could see myself buying the non-cellular edition if they still do the white ceramic edition, because I really want one of those. I saw one in the shop yesterday. I was at the Apple store and I was looking at it going, oh, I want that so bad. It's a nice looking watch. But I'm like, I'm not stupid enough to buy one yet. I'll wait until see what Series 3 brings. But I can't see myself buying the cellular one because I have absolutely no use for having my watch having a cellular connection. It's of no use to me because I do all of my fitness inside. I can see why people would like it for, you know, running and all that stuff like we discussed last time, but it's of no interest to me. So I'm more interested in seeing what other new stuff the Series 3 watches will have, be that new sensors for monitoring, God knows what. Like, there's been a lot of talk about it doing blood sugar levels and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah, that would be interesting.
Improved diagnostics and stuff. And if they have that and a faster CPU, then I'd be all in. I'd be like, yep, I'll buy a new one. And I'll go for the nice polished white ceramic if they still do it. Because, of course, they might do something completely different for the edition this year. Because they completely changed it last time.
That's right. It was 15 grand, wasn't it, or something originally? And now it's sort of
12 grand of gold. And now it's how much is it? I think it's about 1,200 for the
which is much more
edition. That's two Millennium Falcons.
Oh God! Oh, I really can't wait for that Falcon.
Speaking of going to the Apple Store the other day, the reason that I went back to the Apple Store the other day is because my iMac was broken again.
Oh, you're joking!
It was having the same problem. It just cut out randomly. But the problem had changed slightly in that now the only way to turn it back on again was to take the power plug out and then plug it back in again. Like, right. Just pressing the power button isn't enough. You have to physically unplug it, plug it back in. And I took it in and I explained to the guy. And I could see the notes that they had from the previous time I went in. Because obviously they write quite a lot of notes while they're typing. And one of them caught my eye. It was the top of it. It just said, "The customer's really cool. He obviously knows what he's talking about." And I was like, "Oh, that's nice." I came out, cool. It put me in a really good mood. And I came back to my wife and I was like, "Oh, I saw this note. It said, oh, the customer's really cool." And she's like, "If the Apple geniuses are calling you cool, that's not a good thing." It's like, oh.
Yeah, it's exactly what my wife would say. I said something like
that. Little bit harsh.
Talking about App Store as a little segue, I did have a little note to mention this because I'd forgotten about it. Which is weird because it's not the sort of thing you'd normally forget about. In-app purchases.
I've been meaning to ask you about this.
In the past, I've always said, and I still maintain that, that you're a fool if you haven't got, if you've got these devices and you've given them to your kids and you haven't locked stuff down, that's, you know, you're an idiot, basically. So this week, I fell into that sort of idiocy. So what happened was typically the kids' devices, which are sort of our devices that we obviously let them, old devices that we let them use, they don't keep them all the time. And typically they'll have to earn them somehow, you know, they earn some screen time or whatever. They're locked down. They've got restrictions for certain things. And we did have lockdowns for purchases. Now, I'm not sure if it's because I've switched to iOS 11 on my device, but basically the family settings was a bit messed up. So what was happening was that if I wanted to quickly install something as an update on these devices, I had to go through some stupid, you know, authorization thing where I had to go. I effectively had to get myself to authorize the thing, even though I was the person using it. Do you see what I mean? So I'm sort of, you know, logging in as Leo on his device and then saying I want to buy this or download this, and then it's saying you have to get authorization from Jason, and then I've got to, you know, it's just like, oh my God. So at one point I've switched this off. I've done something where I've turned this authorization off and I've left it. So anyway, what happened was, now normally it's not an issue because he still has to purchase with a password. So he would have to do an in-app purchase, it would come up with a password, and he'd still have to know that password, which he doesn't. So that would be, that's still a way you can stop that. You know, it was fairly safe. The problem is there's a setting somewhere in there that talks about fingerprint purchasing, obviously. And what he's done, because he knows the passcode of the device, not the restriction passcode, because that can be different, but the normal unlock device passcode, he's gone into Touch ID stuff and registered. And he's not done this maliciously. He's just playing. You know, he likes the fingerprint unlock. He wants to unlock with a fingerprint. So he's done that. It's an old iPhone 5S. So he's done that, and he's logged his fingerprint. Now, of course, when it pops up with the thing saying, do you want to buy it, it now has to use the fingerprint.
That is a flaw.
Yeah, big flaw. So basically what
the parental controls weren't working, so you didn't like get the notification saying, Leo wants to buy, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. Didn't get that, but also I can't switch that on easily now. When I try and switch it on, I'm told the account that I'm trying to switch it on for needs to have a registered payment card, which is crazy. Because that's not what I want to do. I want to share my payment card. So I don't know what's going on there. And I'll look into that separately. But the end result of all this was that I was getting some emails through saying, you know, in-app purchase for Clash of Clans, £20, £10, you know, whatever. It started off quite small. It was like a few £2.99 or something.
That's how it works with crack dealers.
and I'm thinking, I know at one point that I did buy him a little add-in, an in-app purchase of a few quid. But I thought, well, there's no way that session, you know, normally these sessions time out after 50 minutes. There's no way he could know the password or anything. So anyway, my wife suddenly goes, look, there's a lot of emails coming in. You know, this doesn't look right. And I'm like starting to look and I'm like, oh my God. So I did a quick count of just what had come in. And it was like £100. So we go to him, look, you know, stop doing this. You can't do this. We're taking the device off you and everything. And I'm going to have to, you know, swallow this or whatever. Anyway, more of these emails start coming in because this stuff isn't instant. You don't normally get the email straight away.
No, the email can be like quite a few days later. It could be like 7 days.
So all of a sudden, I start adding up these emails, and I'm using Inbox, which sort of gives you this weird way of grouping everything. And I wasn't sure whether some of these things were duplicates. So I then look into it a bit more, and I'm starting to count up these numbers, and I'm getting up to 770 quid. And, you know, my wife's in shock. I'm sort of thinking, I can't believe this has happened.
Bit more of a Millennium Falcon.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm on, right, I need to get onto Apple. I need to see these transactions. The other problem here is that the family stuff is so messed up. I can't go in to my account, my iCloud account, look at him under my family settings and see the in-app purchases he's done. I can't do it. So I have to log into his account through iTunes. So I actually had to go in and log in to the website and actually look at invoices to actually give me the references, because that's what Apple needed.
Yeah.
So I finally find, it all happened really quickly. I go onto a chat with Apple, just a little chat. I was on the phone or on my computer, actually, just chatting to them. They said, okay, go into this site, get a list of all the invoice numbers. So you couldn't just dump this data list, annoyingly. So
it's manual process.
Copy and paste each one. And so I said, look, you know, this was all, I explained exactly what I've just said to you, exactly how it happened. He manages to register a fingerprint, and that then bypassed all the purchasing thing, and he was allowed to just purchase stuff. And they said, okay, escalated it to a supervisor. This all took place probably in about 20 minutes. And then they come back and said, yeah, it's fine, we're going to refund you the 938 quid. And I'm like, what? I thought it was 700 quid. So that, now there's two things here that's frustrated me. Even though I know that this is, you know, you shouldn't let yourself get into this situation.
That's just poor parenting, Jason. That's what that is.
Yeah, exactly. I got a full refund and everything. But there's two things that really bothered me. One is, he is a family member of my account who has actually been created as a child account. So they have his age, and they know through the data that this kid is a 7-year-old or 6-year-old, 8-year-old even. He's an 8-year-old kid. They know that. They know he's the person making the purchase. And they know the frequency of the purchases that are going on. You would, you know, in any normal situation, like with your bank, if you go and buy a Millennium Falcon and you go and buy an iPhone and you start buying these things on your card, you know, I'll typically get HSBC contacting me saying, we're just worried about fraud, even though it's the thing I do pretty much every year, apart from the Millennium Falcon. You know, their fraud team will pick it up. It's the way it works. What I don't understand is how Apple could just be so laid back in terms of, you know, not looking at this going, hold on a minute, there's a kid account here that's using in-app purchasing.
It's something that isn't just about kids. It's something that when I was running Wallaby, which is a freemium game for people that don't know, one of the things I was going to do in the version 2 update was a thing that I called ethical in-app purchases, where on the screen where you pay for like the in-app currency and stuff, it would show you how much you'd spent in the past month. And if you got to a certain limit, we'd basically cut you off unless you emailed in and said, no, I want to remove the limit or whatever it might be, because I felt that people were spending, I mean, there were some people that spent like 500, 600 quid on it a month, and it was crazy. But I, you know, some of them you find out, they're like, oh yeah, at work they give us bonuses in the form of iTunes gift cards, and so I just spend it all on that. So there's like one woman that was getting like 500 quid a month in like iTunes gift cards, so she just spent it on that because she didn't have anything else she wanted, and it's like, okay, well, that's fair enough. Whereas other people, it's like, you're probably spending too much on this.
Yeah.
So I've always thought that Apple should have, to be honest, part of the reason I wanted to do it was because I was going to do like a big article about it. I'd be like, oh, hey, look, we're the first people to be doing this, and this is how Apple should be doing it. Because I could see the writing on the wall, and I thought, this is coming at some point, and we'll get screwed over by it when it does come. So I want to sort of get ahead of that. But I am amazed that that still is not there. Like, I would think that once you've got over, I mean, obviously it should be different if it's a child's account anyway, but even for an adult account, if you've spent £100 on in-app purchases in 24 hours, it should stop it and then be like, are you really sure you want to be doing this?
Yeah.
Like, send you an email or something. Because it's just like, it's too easy to fall into it, because it's just gambling in a lot of ways. A lot of these things are just gambling.
And there's no difference between this and like your mobile phone when you travel or you do roaming and stuff, and you get, you know, you go to Europe or you go and you're not on the sort of Euro deal or whatever, and you'll suddenly find out, you'll get a text message saying you've spent this much today and, you know, you need to lift your limits. It's that sort of thing. But what's worse is that they have the data to know. Well, the other thing that bothers me is the fact that I can't, you know, by turning back on the feature to say I need to authorize purchases, it's telling me I have to add a card to his account. which doesn't make sense because this is supposed to be a family account where I'm sharing my payment details and they're using my cloud services and all that stuff. It's supposed to come back to me and I'm the one who's supposed to authorize it for payment from me. It seems completely crazy that I'm being asked to add a credit card or a debit card to a minor's account. You know, a child's account.
Definitely sounds like something's gone wrong, probably is because of iOS 11 betas, to be honest. It's because that is how it's supposed to work, as you say. Because, I mean, exactly. I've got it set up for the family and my wife buys stuff and comes off my card just because it's easier to manage it all. And I think if I want to, I can add her as a child and then authorize all her purchases, which always seems a bit mean. So,
But it's
she didn't ever buy anything, but I think she forgets.
It was dealt with in 20 minutes. And the thing is that I think people forget this. I mean, it is quite straightforward. If you're not happy, you know, you can't easily get refunds and stuff from the App Store. But actually, if you go through a little process within iTunes, you can. You know, and I've done it before where I've bought apps.
Yeah,
I've bought apps that were just crap. And you had to buy them to download them. They didn't work properly. And so I've gone back in. And I did get that issue I think I spoke to you about when I got this message that was popping up after I'd done a couple of these. Because they were valid. I wasn't trying to rip anyone off. They just I realized I could claim back some of these app purchases. So I did. And I got a message when I bought more stuff that month, when I downloaded more apps saying, you know, you will not be able to
get a refund
or something. Yeah, basically, because in that month, in that billing period, I'd got too many refunds and they basically thought you're taking the mickey, which is fine.
It's the same way that Steam works for computer games on a PC. So I buy a lot of games a lot of the time through that. And sometimes I refund them if they're terrible, which sometimes they are. But their system's quite good because if you've played, as long as you've bought it within 14 days and you've played it for less than 2 hours, then they'll refund it, no questions asked. It's an automatic process. And the money goes into your account and they can restrict it. Like they can make you wait 7 days for it. Like it might be in your account, but you can't spend it yet and stuff like that. But that varies. I mean, it depends on like your rating and stuff and if you've done this a lot before. But if you start doing it too much, then they can be like, no, you're not getting them anymore, or it needs to be referred to a supervisor each time because you're taking the piss. Or if you try and get a refund outside of that 2 hour window or the 14 day thing. So maybe you played it for 2 hours and 10 minutes. So I did that for one game because I'd bought it and it was great. And then the week later, everyone stopped playing it because there was like a free period or something, and now they didn't have that anymore, and so the number of users online was like 17, and it just never connected, never worked. And I messaged them and I was like, look, I'm sorry, I played it for 10 minutes over the 2 hour limit because it was fine, but now there's no one online, so you can't physically play the game because there's no single player mode. And they were like, yeah, it's fine. It just got it got done a day later, it was fine. And I think I had to wait like 7 days to get that money back rather than the usual 24 hours, whatever it is. But, that system works fine. iTunes refund policy tends to be pretty good. It's pretty easy. Yeah. I've only ever had a problem once where it didn't work, which was really annoying. I bought a PDF editing app on the Mac App Store that cost like 50 quid, but it was the only one that was available that did the thing I needed to, where I could edit values in a PDF and it kept the exact same font and made it nice and easy. And I got it and I used it and it was fine, and I probably used it not very much, probably in like 15 minutes. But then 2 months later, I opened it up again and it had been updated, and the update had broken the feature that I'd bought it for. And I emailed Apple and I was like, look, I've had this for 2 months, but the feature that I bought it for doesn't work anymore. I can't use it. I've used it for like less than 15 minutes in total. Like, can I get a refund for it? Because I can't download an old version because they don't do that functionality. There's no way to roll back. And I couldn't get it from the developer because they couldn't verify that I'd actually bought it, bought a copy on the Mac App Store and then give me a non-Mac App Store copy, if you see what I mean, because they only distribute that way. And they were like, no, we're not giving you a refund. I was like, oh. And they referred it to a supervisor, but they're just like, no, you've had it for too long. We can't do that.
Oh, dear.
I was like, oh, that's a bit shit. But That's just a problem with buying stuff on the Mac App Store, I guess.
Yeah.
But generally they're pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. And like you say, the refund process, is there. It's just not as simple. Well, it is simple. It's just you've got to find it and go through the process. It's not it's not just clicking a box and saying I want my money back. It's a bit more.
I actually have slightly a templated email. I have a templated email of how to do that process, because I had to do that as my support job for when I was running Wallaby, because quite often people would, you know, purchases would be made accidentally or whatever, and they'd ask me for the money back, and I'd be like, well, I can't give you the money back because I don't have it. You have to go through Apple for that, but they're pretty good. And never had a problem. I never had anyone come back to me who'd bought an in-app purchase incorrectly or something and then tried to get a refund from Apple and didn't get one. They always got one. So,
and it's the same with anything else. It's like PayPal. You know, if there's an opportunity that I'll pay for something and it's PayPal, I'll always do PayPal because you get the protection. It's nice having that sort of ability to go back to someone else and get that sort of, you know, get a refund back for something you're not happy with. Although I did have some guy try it. I think I mentioned this before. Try it with a watch. Did I tell you this story? It was an old series. Sure. It was the first Apple Watch. First Apple Watch. Sold my wife's one. So people were referring it to as the Series Zero, I think.
Series Zero. Yeah.
Yeah. So I put it up as a Series Zero first Apple Watch. You know, 38 mil. Put it up as a price. This guy buys it, and I get a message through saying, oh, I didn't realize it was a Series Zero. I wanted a Series One. It's like, well, you should have gone search for a Series One then. can I have my money? Yeah. Can I have my money back? And it's like, no, you can't. You know, you can't. That's not how it works, basically. And I don't know what you've done with it, or if you've used it or broken it or whatever. So no. And then that was the end of it. And then months later, like earlier this year, I got a message from PayPal saying a claim had been made. And the claim was that the guy had tried to install it, but it was locked to my account still, and so it was unusable, and he'd been on the phone to Apple, and I was like, that's horseshit. So it was the same guy, you know, basically. So he's changing his story. So they sort of freeze that, and so my account was now in
negative. Yeah, they go into that like escrow thing.
Yeah, so I basically sent some photos and proof and went into my iCloud account, and they said it wasn't true, and they said, okay, it's fine, and they upheld it. So it works both ways.
But it also, you can get screwed over by that if you don't keep your stuff up to date, because I've had loads of problems on eBay, like selling iPhones, because quite often you'll sell one and then you won't get the payment for ages. And what happens is that other people selling iPhones will buy yours so that they can get it out the way, so that people will go and buy their one that's ending like an hour after you. So they just won't pay you on time, and then they just won't ever pay you, and it disappears. And it's like, and the bad experience I had was when I posted one to someone, and it's all they want. Oh, can I have it without registered delivery? Because I won't be at home, and I just want it to be dropped off when I get. I said, no, no way. It has to be signed for, because otherwise, you know, if you don't do that, which I've done before as well, then people say it never arrived, and then you get screwed out of a phone.
Exactly.
But what this guy did is he received a phone. I didn't hear anything, didn't get any feedback, nothing. And then 45 days later, they filed a complaint to say it never arrived. And by that point, I'd thrown away the receipt from the phone, from the Royal Mail with the tracking code on, the proof of postage, because it was just in my wallet. And I was like, oh, I don't need that anymore. That's all done. That was ages ago. And he'd waited until the very last day that you could apply to PayPal to say that it hadn't happened. And I was like, look, he's never said to me that it's not arrived. Like, would you not think if you'd bought an iPhone that you would say before 45 days, where's my phone? But he hadn't done anything like that. Had no complaint, nothing, and then it was just like that. And PayPal said, sorry, you've not got proof of delivery. Upheld his end of the complaint. And so not only was I out of a phone, I was out of the money for it as well. So it's like,
That is annoying.
So it was really bad. So then I didn't use eBay again after that. I refuse to use it now. I just Music Magpie the stuff. I don't get as much money for it, but it's a hell of a lot safer and easier.
Yeah, that's
they're pretty good now.
That's really rude. It's a good little scam, though. I mean, I never thought about that one in terms of them, you know, buying your one to keep it off, keep it off the, you know, then they sell their one and then don't pay. Yeah, that's a crafty scam.
The moral of the story with the tracking code is to always take a photograph of your receipt, because then it'll just be stored in your photos account and it's there forever and you don't have to worry about it. And then if you need to go back and find it, you've got, you know, a photograph of it there. And I never did that. I just keep them in my wallet. But always take a photo of your receipts if you're selling anything on eBay. That's my little lesson of the day. Just a little bit of in progress. What's it called? Not feedback. Follow-up. Mm-hmm. That's the one. The Apple Watch Edition Ceramic, which comes with a pebble band, is £1,250. at the 38mm size and £1,300 at the 42mm size.
Wow.
You it's just a nice get looking a sport band with it. Yeah, I'd be interested to see how well it'll look with some of my straps. It'd look pretty shit with some of them, but other ones it'll look pretty good, I think.
Yeah, the first
I mainly
one
just
I
use
went
the
with...
sport bands now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I find that they're the most comfortable. And the problem is I had the stainless steel, and I used to wear that with a brown saddle, brown leather strap, which matched the saddle brown leather case for the iPhone 6S. And it was like really nice because I liked the fact that they were like synchronized. And then I bought the black aluminium Series 2 because I thought, oh, I'll go for something a bit different. I don't want to spend the money on the stainless steel one because I don't need to. It's not that much different. So I went for that one. I went for the black. But the problem then is that most of my straps don't match it so well. Like my black leather one does, but the brown leather obviously looks stupid with it because it's got a stainless steel lug and then it's brown leather against a anodized aluminium. It's like, yeah, that doesn't look great. So now I nearly always wear the sport bands with it. So I think they're actually really comfortable. They're really nice. But I'll be interested to see how well some of the straps I have look with the white ceramic, because again, I don't think the brown leather might do if it had white lugs, but it doesn't. It's got the stainless steel ones, so it might look a bit stupid with that, which would be a shame. So I think I'd probably just keep sport bands. But I find it interesting that the most expensive watch they sell just comes with a sport band. Doesn't even come with like a nice custom white leather or something.
Yeah, I can't
it's
wear
pretty
the
good,
leather bands.
I don't think I'd wear that.
I've tried the Apple leather bands, but they irritate my skin for some reason. I think I had that problem years ago with old watches. So I have to wear some sort of metal band or the sport band. And what I did, originally I bought the silver, the stainless steel, the normal stainless steel watch, and I switched to the black version, the anodized version, when I got the Series 2, just as a change.
Very
but also,
tempted by that.
Well, it's because the micro scratches. It's all the micro scratches that you get on the stainless steel one are really easy to see, whereas the black one you don't see them. So it just feels like it's newer. It always feels like it's as new as it was, you know. And you don't get that wear. And then what I have done is I have bought some Apple straps, but I've also just bought some third party ones off Amazon. Not replicas, but just different styles. So different style band, you know, different style stainless steel bands. Which, you know, they're so cheap, but they work. They're really good. If they break, you don't care. You get another one. If you scuff them, you know, you don't care. You get another one because they're so cheap. But some of them are really nice. I mean, I've got one on now that's like a, almost looks like a sort of bracelet design. It's like, it looks like loads of, you know, like, what's the good description? It's just like loads of little rectangles that are sort of all smoothed off. And it just looks really nice. It matches the colors. You can't see the clasp, but it's a really nice, you know, design. Doesn't irritate my wrist. It looks nice and seems to be
a lot of a lot of companies that make nice Apple Watch straps now. Like I saw Tom's Shoes, they make fabric ones, which are quite nice, some of those. And there's, I think, I want to say Crew, but I don't think that's the name of the company. But there was someone, I looked at their website, and they have a leather one, which has got like a nice stitching, and then it's got like a little embroidered dinosaur on it. And I was like, oh, I want that. But the problem with buying nice ones like that is that they cost the same as the Apple ones. They're like, you know, £120 or something for a nice leather one. It's like, I need to stop buying Apple Watch bands. But I've not bought any off Amazon. I had a little look on Amazon because I wanted the Product Red sport band, but it was out of stock at the time. And then I looked on Amazon and I saw a couple of like knockoff ones. And I'm not sure because the thing I like about the sport band is that the feel of it is actually really good. It doesn't feel like plastic. It's like a rubbery type. It's weird. It's really comfortable though. And I was like, I don't really know if I want to get like a plasticky one that's going to, you know, it's going to irritate like the Fitbit Flex bands did. So
yeah,
I'm not bothered. But
I got a knockoff Nike one or Nike one from Amazon that was like £10 or something, and it looks exactly the same. But what's happened, I've noticed wearing it for a few weeks, is that the sort of surface of the plastic, the surface of the rubber is coming off. So, you know, you get quality issues definitely with some of these cheap ones, depending on what you get. But it's much more disposable. You know, if you're buying a £10 band and it gets worn out, you don't really care that much. But the nice thing about Amazon, obviously, is which we always love, is the Prime stuff. So you can buy it, you can wear it for a couple of weeks, and if it wears out, you just send it back. You know, that's the beauty of the 30-day purchase, which is why I pretty much spend most of my time purchasing stuff on Amazon, because I get that protection.
I really want one of the new Nike Bands. They've got a blue one, like the one with the holes. It's like blue, and then the inside of the holes is white. Because I already have a black band and I already have a white band, so the mixtures of the white and the blacks are of no interest to me. It's like, I don't need one that a few extra holes in. But the blue one, I was like, I really want that. That looks quite nice. But it's just out of stock all the time. I can never get it. And I saw one in the Apple store yesterday on the display. Like, I could see it, like, under the case with, like, a steel watch. I was like, that's the one I want. And I looked online and it's like, nope, out of stock. Can't pick up anywhere. And I was like, what? Why? Where is it? It's like... when the first watch came out, I bought one for me and then I bought one for my wife. And I got her the one that came with a coral pink strap. And it came like 2 weeks later because they seemed to have massive production problems with the coral pink band, because anyone that ordered the pink one, no one got them for like 2 weeks after it arrived.
Wow.
Because I was like on Mac Rumors forum and everyone's like saying when their watches are arriving and everyone's like, where are the pink ones? There's just none of them anywhere. No one's seen one. None of the review units were pink either. And they seem to have massive problems making that particular colour. So maybe they've got issues of the same type with this particular blue band. And it's just taking a lot while longer, but frustrating. But never mind.
Yeah, we'll see what happens in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'm learning Falcon instead.
Well, you've got to head off, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got to prepare the house because I've got my father-in-law coming over this evening. Hooray.
Cool.
Okay, it's a good thing. He's nice. It's not. That sounded horrible. I doubt he listens to this, but just in case.
Cool. Well, I've had an unproductive week so far this week because it's two of my daughter's birthdays on Tuesday. So we had Tuesday all day sort of, you know, birthday stuff. And then yesterday was all day birthday stuff.
That's pretty awesome.
It's been an interesting week. Things hopefully getting back to normal next week. Cool.
Awesome. Well, I'll catch you up in a couple of weeks.
And, okay, great.
And then, actually, let me think.
Yep.
The next time we talk, it'll be after the announcement.
Yes.
So it'll be literally the day after, I would imagine, 13th.
Yep. Yep.
So good luck if anything comes out that you need to pre-order.